today. The mysterious story of one of Britain's most infamous business tycoons.
At the beginning of November 1991, Maxwell went on board his yacht, Lady Ghislaine, named after his youngest daughter and his favourite child. And he went on his own, which was unusual. He almost always went with quite a kind of large retinue of staff.
John Preston is a journalist and author. He's spent months delving into the life of media magnate Robert Maxwell for his new book.
They cruised rather aimlessly around the Canary Isles for a few days, and he was due to fly back to London on the morning of the 5th of November 1991, and he knew that he was effectively going to be facing three, as it were, firing squads, because the fraud squad were after him, the Mirror pensioners had discovered that he'd been stealing their money, and the bankers were also calling in his enormous loans.
Maxwell was notorious for his lavish lifestyle and business empire, which spectacularly unravelled shortly after his unusual death.
At about 3 o'clock in the morning, he went out on deck, and sometime after that, probably around 3:30 in the morning, he disappeared overboard.
The end of Maxwell's life has been the subject of many conspiracy theories.
Either he was bumped off, or he jumped, or he fell.
Now, this tragic figure provides the backdrop to another story, that of his daughter, Ghislaine Maxwell, who is charged with aiding Jeffrey Epstein's sexual abuse. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, the life and death of Robert Maxwell. Where does Robert Maxwell's story start, John? Where did he grow up?
He was born in 1923 in this really very small village, which is in the west of what was then Czechoslovakia. Very poor, large Jewish population. His parents were Jewish. He was one of seven children. Very, very bright boy, but they lived in extreme poverty.
They were very poor. We didn't have things that other people had. They had shoes and they had food and we didn't.
What was his relationship like with his family? Do we know if he was close to them?
He absolutely adored his mother. His mother had this peculiar conviction that Maxwell was going to grow up and become rich and famous. And everybody she told this to fell about laughing when Maxwell was a child. He had a more ambivalent relationship with his father. He was frightened of his father. It reputedly, once Maxwell was sick in the street and his father rubbed his face in his own vomit, and Maxwell never quite got over that. When Maxwell was 17, he left home and set off essentially to find his fortune. So Maxwell claimed that he'd walked 270 miles to Budapest. Sounds like a very good story. The friend that he went with said it was nonsense. They'd actually gone by train. One of the things about Maxwell was that he had this extraordinary technicolor life.
But it was a life marked early on by tragedy.
My family were wiped out with millions of others in Auschwitz.
During the war, three of his siblings, both his parents and his grandfather, all died in Auschwitz.
How do you feel about it now? I mean, that must be difficult to lose that kind of hatred.
The sorrow of those losses are ever before me.
And your own hatred?
I don't hate as I did during the war, but I cannot forget or forgive.
So that's really the kind of prism through which you have to view Maxwell. He, meanwhile, had joined up with the British Army and indeed won a military cross. So Maxwell started off as a private. He taught himself English largely by listening to Winston Churchill's speeches on the radio, which is partly why he had such an extraordinary voice.
We must exercise reasonable prudence and a certain amount of guile in combating the malice of the enemy.
And you can just about detect Churchill's sort of rumbling cadences somewhere in the back of Maxwell's voice.
I chose to come to Britain after the Battle of France, And when I landed here in September 1940, I came not as a refugee, but with a rifle in my hand.
He had a reputation for being ruthless. Was that something you found?
Yes, I think he was ruthless. The Allies were advancing through what had been German-occupied France, and he may well have shot unarmed Germans who had already surrendered.
I had a determination to kill Germans, which equaled the horrors that they were inflicting on a lot of innocent people.
He was very, very highly regarded, both by his superior officers and indeed largely by his men. He then comes back at the end of the war and he's in Berlin in 1946. He becomes a spy for British intelligence. And he's a very useful spy for British intelligence, who actually indeed end up setting him up in business when he comes back to London.
And he suggested that we should subsidise him to buy a bookshop.
This was Maxwell.
Or book business, yes.
So you picked him, Maxwell was to be your agent?
Yes, basically, yeah.
Towards the end of the war, Maxwell met a young, intelligent French woman called Betty, who would go on to become his wife. She came from a wealthy family who were unimpressed with Maxwell, a man who appeared to have no prospects. But Betty saw something in him. And it was around this time that Maxwell started carving out his business empire, acquiring a vast collection of scientific papers from Germany, which he began publishing.
In the tweedy, helplessly antiquated world of British publishing in the 1940s and 50s, no one had ever come across anyone like Maxwell before. He blew them out of the water. He was a brilliant salesman. As you say, he was ruthless. But he was also selling kind of pork bellies and prefabricated houses and pretty well anything that came his way. I think it's very important to remember that although one of Maxwell's eyes was constantly fixed on his profit margins, there was a kind of unexpectedly idealistic side to him. And I think that he did care deeply about the manuscripts that he published. Maxwell is now seen as such a villainous figure. But he was directly responsible for a lot of very important advances in medicine and physics, biology in the 50s, because he gave these academics a platform to disseminate their views that they simply hadn't had before. And by the mid-50s, he's the largest publisher in the world of scientific manuscripts. And this is the middle of the Cold War. He does this brilliant deal with the Russians. The idea that anybody in the West would make up, you know, trade deals with the Russians was pretty much unheard of. He'd had a very good war, and he went on to have a very good Cold War.
And meanwhile, what was Maxwell's family life like?
Betty and Maxwell lived in this huge Italianate mansion in Oxford called Headington Hill Hall, which Maxwell didn't actually own. It was owned by the local council and they rented it to him. They went on to have 9 children.
We both teach them that having money isn't just everything. The privilege of money also imposes duties and limitations.
Two of whom died young. There was a daughter who died, and then in the same week that Ghislaine, their youngest child, was born, the oldest son and designated heir, Michael, was very, very badly injured in a car crash and was in a coma for the next 7 years. And this cast inevitably a terrible shadow over the family. Michael, the oldest son, is lying in a coma in a hospital literally a mile away from where the family live, and his name is never mentioned. I spoke to Maxwell's chauffeur, who would drive him down at night from London, and they would go to the hospital, and Maxwell would sit by his son's bedside and talk to him, hoping for some response. And yet he never told his wife that he was doing this, which begs the obvious question, why? And I feel that perhaps he just didn't want to admit vulnerability, and it was so hurtful for him. It's from that moment on that the family starts to fracture. Things start to go wrong at home, although they appear to be going extremely well for Maxwell in business.
What was Maxwell like as a father?
He was a very stern disciplinarian. He beat the children if they misbehaved. I mean, that, of course, wasn't that unusual at the time. There used to be these terrible rituals where at Sunday lunch, which they had around a big dining table in Headington Hill Hall, Maxwell would ask each of the children in turn what they'd done during the week, what they hoped to accomplish in the next week. And sometimes they'd have to kind of give forth about key issues in current affairs. And one of Maxwell's daughters told me that she used to sit there as a child and the searchlight of Maxwell's gaze would pass around the table and she used to just dread it as it came closer and closer and closer. You know, when the children needed emotional comfort, they certainly didn't rush to their father.
Robert Maxwell wasn't content with just being a businessman, was he? He was keen to enter into politics, and he was eventually elected as Labour MP for Buckingham in 1964.
Well, now, here are some more of the results that Mr Wilson is waiting for. Buck's Tory loss, which means that Captain Maxwell has taken the Buckinghamshire seat for Labour.
What was he like as a politician?
He soon got this reputation for being a colossal windbag. They couldn't shut him up. On one occasion, he gave such a long speech that his fellow Labour MPs were tugging on his jacket to try and get him to sit down. He just completely ignored them. But he was a very conscientious MP, and he was rather well-liked in Buckingham.
You sort of make it sound like, in Westminster at least, some regarded him with some annoyance. But why was it important for Maxwell to become an MP?
He wanted recognition. He wanted to exercise power and influence. He wanted to be needed. And he thought that politics held out the most obvious route to those things. But then fairly quickly he cottoned on that he was never going to make it as a successful politician. So he quite sort of adroitly changed course and decided that he would try and become a newspaper baron instead.
And that wasn't that easy, was it? Tell me what happened when in 1969 he tried to buy the News of the World.
What happened was that this young, unknown Australian called Rupert Murdoch snatched it from under his nose. Their fates would be kind of entwined with one another for the next 30 years. And every time Maxwell tried to buy a newspaper, Murdoch, as it were, stole it from under his nose. And it drove Maxwell nuts.
There's been a lot of acrimony throughout the stages of this takeover bid.
We've never said anything personal.
Hasn't it developed into
a personal battle? Mr. Maxwell called me a moth-eaten kangaroo. Well, I've never got quite to that stage.
I mean, really, he came to see Murdoch as this kind of terrible nemesis who was out to thwart him at every turn.
Why was it that Murdoch got that News of the World deal ultimately and Maxwell didn't?
When I interviewed Murdoch, he said, I could smell that the establishment wouldn't let him in. Although Murdoch was Australian, he certainly wasn't a member of the establishment himself, Maxwell was more of an outsider. He put a lot of people's backs up. There was a great deal of anti-Semitism in the city at the time. And I think they felt, no, we're going to teach this upstart a lesson. They let Murdoch have it on terms that Maxwell just couldn't understand because he reckoned his offer was better.
So Maxwell was denied the opportunity to buy the News of the World then. But around this time, sort of late 60s, how are his other businesses doing? Was he successful?
Well, they appeared to be incredibly successful, and yet all was not well. Maxwell had basically been inflating his profits. And in the subsequent inquiry by the Department of Trade and Industry, Maxwell was branded an unfit person to run a public company. And this was a terrible, terrible humiliation for him. And it meant that he was kind of cast into outer darkness.
For all practical purposes, I should have been dead and gone then. It feels awful. I lost 5 years of my life.
Betty, his wife, said the invitations literally vanished from their mantelpiece overnight, and they were ostracised. But Maxwell fought back, and he succeeded in buying the company back just a few years later. He clawed his way back, not necessarily to respectability, but to the point where the city were only too happy to do business with him again.
Maxwell then left those business woes behind him for a bit. And over the next years, he purchased Oxford United.
And having made a few shillings as a publisher and printer, and accepting that there are public responsibilities of a person like myself, I felt I must not allow this club to go under.
He rescued the largest printing company in Europe, BPC, from bankruptcy. But how did he eventually realise his dream of owning a newspaper?
He eventually, in 1984, got hold of the Mirror. This is his dream. It means that he and Murdoch are essentially the two biggest power brokers in British political life.
We will not join the Sun in the sewers of its own creation. The difference between the Sun and the Mirror is simply this. They are a sleazy magazine who goes really in for soft porn. We will not join them in that.
And do we know, like, how happy Maxwell was to take over the Mirror and how he entered into that on day one?
He was absolutely thrilled. He walked into the Mirror like a kind of conquering hero, and he ran the Mirror like his own personal fiefdom, really. I mean, within, I think it's about the first 2 months of his being there, more than 100 pictures of Maxwell had appeared in the Mirror. And he was always fronting newspaper campaigns.
Play Win a Million in the Daily Mirror, Sunday Mirror, or Sunday People. From now on, I guarantee you will all get a fair and equal chance to play and win one of our millions.
No one was in any doubt whatsoever that Maxwell owned the Mirror.
You spoke earlier, John, about Maxwell's desire to fit into British society. Was this the moment that that happened for him?
I think he did feel that to begin with. But I also think that Maxwell's life, in many respects, is like a sort of terrible morality tale of someone for whom nothing was ever enough. And you feel that throughout his life, he was kind of searching for this elusive something that would give him a sense of contentment and fulfilment. And he never got it. I'm sure he felt that owning the Mirror was going to be like the Holy Grail in that respect. But it wasn't, because as soon as he'd got the Mirror, he suddenly then tries to go toe-to-toe with Murdoch.
I am committed to getting the Mirror on top of the Sun. I have set myself a target of 2 years to achieve the goal.
Look at Mr. Murdoch's achievements and look at mine. Both of us are candidates for one of the top positions as a media company of the world, one of the 10 slots. He's doing very well. I'm not doing too badly.
But he'd kind of signed his own death warrant, certainly his own financial death warrant. And from that moment on, Maxwell started raiding the pension funds in order to prop up bits of his empire. And he was essentially robbing Peter to pay Paul.
And what was going on in Maxwell's personal life at this point? You know, what was his lifestyle like and his relationship with Betty?
Well, his relationship with Betty starts to fall apart, really, in the 60s. And he treats her very unpleasantly. He sort of humiliates her in public. He ignores her. He spends less and less time at home. He had had affairs. He didn't really like being tied down. He increasingly got megalomania and pushed everybody away, everybody who'd once been close to him, his wife, his children, and he ends up entirely isolated.
One man and the company he founded has done more than any other to harness the communications revolution. The man is Robert Maxwell. The company is Maxwell Communication Corporation.
Was he living a pretty lavish lifestyle by this point as well, John?
Yes, I mean, he ate vast amounts of caviar and drank champagne.
He would just say, I want smoked salmon. I want caviar. I want champagne. And it was provided for him.
And would have his morning coffee out of an enormous cup with very important person written round the sides. He's obviously got his yacht, the Lady Ghislaine. he becomes fascinated by helicopters, so he buys the largest helicopter company in the UK. He'd love to kind of drop in on people unexpectedly. You know, he would land in their back garden and turn up at birthday parties and things like this, rather to the horror of people. Again, it's this sort of seeing himself in this almost sort of godlike way of kind of descending from the heavens. So, yes, he is leading a very lavish lifestyle, but he doesn't enjoy his possessions.
As the owner of the Mirror, what was he like to work for?
You hear a lot of stories about, oh, it was hell working for Maxwell at the Mirror. But actually, a lot of people loved working for Maxwell because it was a hoot. He put lots of money into the paper. The paper certainly was successful for a time. And, you know, Maxwell was one of those people who made things happen around him. Life was never, ever dull.
Maxwell was leading a double life in many ways then. On the one hand, it was incredibly opulent, fun, and he was liked by many at the Mirror. But unbeknownst to them, he was raiding their pensions. Was all of this having an impact on him mentally?
You know, Maxwell died in 91. He buys Macmillan in 88. Those 3 years, everything really falls apart. Financially, things are falling apart. Mentally and physically, he's falling apart as well. So much so that he has the Mirror offices bugged so he can listen to what people are saying about him. The bugs were in the telephones. Some of them were in the lights. And he would have these recording devices in his office and actually in his apartment as well. And he couldn't sleep at night. And he would just sit there listening to these tapes of people talking about him. And I think it drove him kind of closer and closer to the edge. I don't think there was any way back for him by that stage, actually. The older he becomes, the more the past is kind of snapping at his heels. He just can never quite escape it. Towards the end of his life, Maxwell actually spent less and less time in Headington Hill Hall, but he was there one night. One of his sons, Ian, walked in. Maxwell had a kind of prototype flat-screen TV, and there was a documentary showing newsreel footage of Jewish people being unloaded from trains at Auschwitz. When Ian walked in, he saw his father with his nose pressed right up against the screen, and he said, "What are you doing?" And Maxwell turned around and said, "I'm looking to see if I can spot my parents." And whatever you may think about Maxwell, that is a desperately poignant story.
Coming up, Robert Maxwell's strange death and how it changed the lives of his children.
Millionaire newspaper publisher Robert Maxwell is dead. He disappeared overboard from his private yacht early this morning while cruising off the Canary Islands.
Earlier this week, the Spanish pathologist who examined Maxwell's body told ITN that suicide couldn't be ruled out completely.
After a night aboard the fateful yacht her father named after her, Ghislaine Maxwell appeared to read a statement on behalf of the family.
I also want to take this opportunity to thank all the many hundreds of people who have sent messages of support to us at this very, very sad time.
Robert Maxwell's body was found on the 5th of November 1991, and his death has courted conspiracy theories ever since, in part because the first autopsy that was carried out on his body was botched. Some believe he took his own life, and others are convinced he was murdered. What do you think happened to him, John?
I have not been able to find any evidence that he was pushed. And it actually just doesn't make sense. I mean, you have to ask yourself, why would anybody go to the trouble and expense of sending a team of amphibious hitmen out into the middle of the Atlantic to board the Lady Ghislaine at dead of night and tip Maxwell into the ocean? When, you know, Maxwell was so addicted to self-publicity, he was virtually walked around with a kind of target pinned to his forehead. It was much, much easier to bump him off on dry land if anyone had wanted to. So I feel that it's kind of a choice between did he jump or was it an accident? My own feeling is that it's quite possible that the line between accident and suicide may be slightly more blurred than we tend to assume, and that maybe he slipped and didn't try quite hard enough to save himself. I think all one can say really is that if it was an accident, it was an astonishingly fortuitous accident, given that he knew what he was coming back to and that he was going to be humiliated.
The latest revelations surrounding the Maxwell Empire are probably the most damaging yet. The resignation last night of Kevin and Ian Maxwell from the board of Mirror Group newspapers signalled the start of a huge inquiry into allegations that Robert Maxwell used some £300 million from the Mirror Pension Fund to prop up some of his other troubled companies.
3 weeks after he died, the story was actually broken by The Guardian, who revealed that there was this colossal hole in the pension funds. And from that moment onwards, it was like the Titanic taking in water. It was only going to end one way. And indeed, it all happened incredibly quickly. Essentially, the entire empire plunged into bankruptcy within a month of his death.
Maxwell was taking money from the Mirror Pension Fund to prop up his other failing businesses. Why did he need to do this?
He pays way, way over the odds for Macmillan, the US publishers. Having forked out this vast amount of money, there was then a recession, interest rates soared, he overreached himself to an absurd degree. I mean, it was just a really crazed thing to do. People pleaded with him not to do it, and he completely ignored them. And the reason he did it was solely so he could prove that he belonged in the same arena as Murdoch.
We are in the second half of the 10 largest media companies in the world. Our aim is in the next 2 or 3 years to move up.
The banks lent him a ton of money, and I just think that's quite interesting.
As more details of the late Robert Maxwell's business dealings are uncovered, it's becoming clear that Britain's high street banks stand to lose the most from the collapse of the private companies. The scandal now threatens to become the biggest in British financial history.
Why did banks keep lending to him, even though he was in huge amounts of debt?
Because he appeared to be financially in blooming good health. You know, he was, in many respects, a brilliant businessman. In his heyday in the early 80s, the banks were only too happy to give him really as much as he wanted. And whenever anybody questioned his solvency, Maxwell would always say, well, of course, I've got billions stashed away in Liechtenstein. Liechtenstein was the tax haven, and they couldn't ask to see it because that's not how it works. So they all went, oh, fine, all right, we'll have some more then.
What impact did his death and his huge financial problems have on his family?
It was absolutely catastrophic. And the children really didn't inherit anything. The Maxwell name is quite a kind of stigma to live with. And obviously what's happened subsequently with Ghislaine.
The woman accused of helping alleged sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein recruit and abuse underage girls is in jail this morning. FBI agents arrested Ghislaine Maxwell yesterday, nearly 1 year to the day after Epstein was arrested. She faces 6 charges, including illegally transporting minors and perjury.
Epstein provided her with a kind of passport to sustain that lifestyle.
And in terms of the debt, the financial problems, how did his family have to pick up the pieces from that?
Kevin and Ian, his two sons, stood trial. They got off. But I think that all the children would say that, you know, life has been difficult subsequently.
The teardrop church where Mary wept, close by the Garden of Gethsemane, lies halfway down the Mount of Olives. At the foot of the slope in the valley is the 9th century BC tomb of the prophet Zechariah, and high above is where Robert Maxwell will be buried this afternoon.
Finally, John, Robert Maxwell was buried in Israel in what can only be described as a state funeral, attended by politicians and dignitaries. It was a far cry from where his life had begun in poverty. Why was his story one that you wanted to tell?
There are very few people who live really big Technicolor mythical lives. And Maxwell was unquestionably one of them. It's hard to think of anyone in the 20th century who journeyed as far from his roots as Robert Maxwell. I felt that when Maxwell died and the story of the pension funds came out, he was seen very much as the embodiment of corporate villainy. And he'd lost all, as it were, definition. But it seemed to me that he was a much more nuanced, fascinating, contradictory figure than that. And I felt that it was worth trying to tell his story, to set it in context, and to tell it for an audience who may well have no idea who he was.
John, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
That was John Preston. His book, Fall, The Mystery of Robert Maxwell, is available to buy now, and it is a really entertaining read. You can find an extract from it at theguardian.com. Today's episode was produced by Alice Fiennes and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Nicholas Alexander. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.